Now, why don't you start at the beginning? As usual, Nancy did most of the talking. And talk she did. By the time she had finished, it was nearly 3 o'clock. They had been there almost 3 hours. And by the time she had finished telling her stories, she was crying her eyes out.
"You've got to help us, Father,"
she said, dabbing at her eyes with a tissue.
"We don't know what's going on, but things aren't right. I think maybe Maurice is haunted or something."
Throughout the 3 hours, Maurice remained quiet, staring down at his hands. He nodded from time to time, confirming things that Nancy was saying. "This is quite disturbing," the priest said. "I don't have much experience with these matters. But it's possible your house is haunted. I'll come out tomorrow and bless the house with holy water. Maybe that will put an end to these strange happenings. In the meantime, you go home and pray." The next day, right after Mass, Father Beardsley got into his black Buick and drove out to the Theriall farmhouse. He was a little bit frightened. He had blessed plenty of houses and people before, but never for any reason like this. He remembered the story of a priest in a neighboring town who had gone out to sprinkle holy water around a house whose owner was thought to be possessed. That priest died an early death. Father Beardsley had taken a large bottle of holy water with him, and by the time he was through, he had used it all. Using a sprinkler known as an aspersorium, he went through every room. As he did it, he prayed. When he was finished, he tried to reassure the Theriales. "I think this may do the trick," he said. "If you have any more problems, call me. There may be other things we can do."
"Thank you, Father," Nancy said. "Thank you so much. I know this is going to work. I just know it."
Father Beardsley wished he were as confident, but he truly had no idea if what he had done would be of any help at all. From the things that Nancy had told him, he feared that the Theriall's problems might require more than just a sprinkling of holy water. The next day, he decided to drive to the mall near Worcester to browse in the bookstore there. They had a lot of books on the supernatural and paranormal. Maybe he could find something to help the Theriales. Looking through the section on religion, Father Beardsley came across a book that jarred his memory. It was called The Demonologist. He remembered it from a TV program he'd once seen about a couple from Connecticut who had devoted their lives to fighting demonic possession. He decided to shell out the $2.95 for the paperback. It seemed a small investment if it could teach him something he might be able to use to help the Theriales. But when he got back home, Father Beardsley put The Demonologist up on his bookshelf and promptly forgot about it. He was growing old, and sometimes things just slipped his mind. He didn't give the book another thought, until a couple of weeks later, when he received a frantic call from Nancy Theriall.
"Father, things are happening to Maurice again," she said. "He was in two places at once."
Father Beardsley didn't understand. "Two places at once?"
"Yes, it's happened before. This time, me and my brother, Hank, his wife, Melissa, and my daughter, Lori, were standing around the kitchen table, and Maurice comes out of the hallway. Hank asks him where he's going, but Maurice doesn't answer. He just went right out the door, like he was a robot or something. He didn't even have any clothes on. But I knew Maurice would never walk out like that, stark naked. Besides, I had seen this thing happen before, where he turns up in two places at once. But before I thought maybe I was crazy, even though I knew in my heart that I wasn't. So I asked Lori to go into the bedroom and see if Maurice was still there. Well, she goes in there, and I hear her scream. Sure enough, he's in there. He's sitting on the edge of the bed, taking his boots off. Blood is seeping from his eyes."
Father Beardsley listened intently to the eerie story. And then he remembered the book he had purchased a few weeks earlier. "Can you hang on a second?" he asked Nancy. "I'll be right back." It only took him a few seconds to find the demonologist. It was right on the shelf where he'd left it. He paged through it until he found the names of the couple he had seen on TV that time. "I think I know some people who can help," he told Nancy when he returned to the phone. "I'm going to call them right now. Just sit tight until you hear from me."
"Okay, but please hurry, Father," Nancy said. "I don't think I can take any more. I'm so worried. I'm at my wit's end."
After hanging up, Father Beardsley gazed out the rectory window for several minutes. Then he picked up the phone again and dialed information for Connecticut. "For Monroe," he said to the operator. "Do you have a listing for Ed and Lorraine Warren?" 9. Ed and Lorraine Warren had just entered the carriage house behind their charming Monroe, Connecticut home, where they were about to teach their weekly class at the New England School of Demonology. The students, mostly high school and college kids from nearby towns, were already seated, ready to be captivated by the lecture Ed was about to deliver on the subject of demons and possession. The candles were lit, and a tape of a Gregorian chant was playing softly in the background. Everything was in its place. A crucifix, a skull, a sword, a book on the supernatural, a statue of a saint. Dozens of these kinds of objects dotted every available bit of wall and shelf space. A jovial, husky man of 58, Ed, with his khaki vest, green plaid lumberjack shirt, and blue jeans, his down-to-earth sense of humor, and his absolute lack of pretense, hardly fitted the image of his profession, especially since the release of the popular movie Ghostbusters. But Ed and his wife, Lorraine, are among the nation's foremost demonologists. They've been at it for more than 40 years, and although they saw the movie and thought it funny, they are dead serious about their work. Ed, born just down the road in Bridgeport, is one of only 7 practicing demonologists in North America. And he's the only one who is not a clergyman. His wife is a trance medium, with strong powers of both clairvoyance and ESP. An attractive, dignified-looking woman, just a few months younger than Ed, Lorraine usually wears her black hair piled up high and has a penchant for wearing large pieces of ornate jewelry. Her eyes have a knowing, calming quality about them that can instantly soothe a troubled mind. Ed first became interested in the world of ghosts and demons as a youngster growing up in a haunted house. Since the 1940s, he and his wife have investigated more than 2,000 cases of the supernatural all over North America, Europe, and Australia. More than 50 of those cases involved demonic possession. Just as they approached the lectern, the telephone rang once. The call had been quickly intercepted by the answering machine that Ed had turned on just before leaving the house, to make sure the class would not be interrupted. Since they had not yet started the class, Lorraine leaned over to Ed and whispered, "Honey, do you want me to get it?" Ed frowned. "That's why we've got an answering machine. We'll return the call as soon as class is over." Lorraine knew Ed was right. Their phone was constantly ringing off the wall. Half the time it was just some crank. Ever since the release of Ghostbusters, everybody and his brother was seeing ghosts. But that didn't mean they didn't have to take each call seriously. Any one of them could be real. And Lorraine felt that this call might be one of those. She sensed that someone was in deep distress, and that she and Ed might be the only ones who could help. She let out a little sigh, thinking she'd go ahead with the class, but she'd probably be distracted, unable to get that phone call out of her mind. Ed took off his vest and placed it over the back of a chair. Lorraine lit 2 more white candles. Then Ed began to pray to St. Michael the Archangel and St. Teresa. The students prayed with them. "Now, I'm going to talk a little about demonic possession," Ed began. "People don't become possessed by devils or demons by accident. Doors have to be opened. Once you try to communicate with them, you open the door." "Sometimes," he said, "that happens when a person starts playing with a Ouija board." "The Ouija board is a definite way to invite spirits in," he said, "and you don't know what kind of spirit you're going to get. It's like going into a crowded street and asking a total stranger to come into your house, he explained. You're likely to run into trouble. Other times, he noted, a person can be singled out as a victim by a deceased relative. And it's not always the devil who possesses people or houses, Ed told the transfixed audience. Rather, it is usually one of millions of demons. These are the angels who were cast out of heaven. Possession, he matter-of-factly explained, is the fourth stage of demonic activity. First comes encroachment, where a negative spirit is given an opening to a human being, either through voluntary means, such as a satanic ritual, or through involuntary means, such as a curse or the performance of an unholy act. The second stage is infestation, when the demons first haunt a person's house. The third stage is oppression, when the spirits begin trying to take over the person living in the house. The final stage, after possession, is death. We're not talking about fairy tales or ghost stories, Ed told his audience. When diabolical energy takes over, it has full command of the body. The person doesn't realize what happens. He can't use his own faculties. Sometimes, Ed added, a person can be possessed by more than one spirit, and spirits can be both human and inhuman. To get rid of the spirits, an exorcist must command them to leave in the name of Jesus, he went on. Ed said that he was not an exorcist. Only an ordained priest can be one. But he described his work with exorcists to help drive out the evil spirits. Then he took a shot at some of the scientific parapsychologists who also study so-called paranormal phenomena. We'll work with them, he said. But we also work with priests. They don't. We believe there is only one person who can deliver a man or a home from a demon. That is an ordained minister of God. A young woman in the front row put up her hand. You have a question? Ed said.
Do weird things really happen like in The Exorcist?
Ed smiled. You mean do objects fly around the house? Do strange voices call out? Do possessed people really perform superhuman feats of strength? Can they speak foreign languages they have never studied? Do they bleed, vomit in grotesque colors? A few students laughed. Don't laugh, Ed said, his expression turning serious. All those things have been known to happen, but that's not the half of it. I have been cut and slashed. Spirits have carved out marks and symbols on my body. I've been tossed around the room like a toy. Demons are very serious, and fighting them is very serious business. Ed explained that when he is called by someone seeking help, his first task is to determine if the disturbance is being caused by a spirit. Like the scientific parapsychologists, he wants to find proof. Unlike them, however, he sometimes finds it. Spirit manifestations are orderly and observable, he said. When they are genuine, Lorraine and I work with the clergy to bring an end to the torture that a person or a family may be going through. One thing that must be determined, Lorraine said, is whether the spirit is human or inhuman. When a spirit is causing phenomena to occur in a home, it's usually being caused by a ghost, she said, explaining that a ghost is the spirit of a human being who died a sudden death and is stuck between worlds. They simply may not realize they are dead, or they may not be emotionally ready to leave this plane. The spirit, she noted, will attempt to make the earthly world aware of its presence by trying to manipulate the physical environment, making sounds, knocking on walls, that sort of thing. Basically, the ghost is calling out for help, Lorraine said. So we help them. We help them move along to the next dimension. They're not evil. They're just unhappy. Then Ed stepped back up to the lectern.
But there's another type of spirit we encounter in our work, he said, his voice louder than before. It's the inhuman spirit. That's an entity totally unworthy of life. And because it is so unworthy, it has been prevented from taking on a physical existence. This is the demon. The name comes from his eternal hate of both man and God. The demonic spirit is another thing altogether from the human spirit. It is dedicated to death and destruction. It can manipulate the physical environment easily, whereas the human spirit usually cannot. The demonic spirit's goal is fear, injury, and, if possible, death. The students were riveted to their seats, but one young man looked at Ed skeptically. Ed could feel a challenge coming on. The young man wore a bulky black wool sweater under a faded blue jean jacket. He was probably no older than 19. He had long blonde hair and a faint trace of a beard. He rolled his eyes as Ed finished his last sentence.
"Come on, how do we know any of this is true?" he blurted out.
Ed just smiled.
"I'm glad you asked that question," he said. "First of all, let me ask you if you believe in God. Do you?"
The young man fidgeted in his seat.
"Well, not really. I'm an atheist, or maybe an agnostic. I'm not really sure. I have to have proof. If God actually showed himself to me, then maybe I'd believe."
Ed pointed to the young man.
"It's atheists like this who never believe," he said. "But it's not just me who says this is so."
He explained that demonology, the study of demons, is a legitimate category of theology, with its own literature. Cases have been studied extensively over many years, he noted. The Roman Catholic Church teaches classes in the subject at its seminaries and universities in Rome. In 1975, Ed told the class, a conference on the subject was held behind closed doors at the University of Notre Dame. The conference was entitled A Theological, Psychological, Medical Symposium on the Phenomenon Labeled as Demonic. Papers that came from the conference confirmed the reality of demonic oppression and possession, said Ed, speaking firmly and punctuating each syllable by tapping his pointer finger on the lectern.
But of course, if you don't believe in the Almighty, then you don't believe in the devil either, he concluded. If that's the case, you probably don't belong here tonight. You may stay, but I ask that you try to keep an open mind. You may learn something. Any other questions?
What was your most frightening case?
Asked an innocent-looking blonde woman in her mid-20s.
That's easy, Ed said. We were involved as the chief investigators of a haunting on Long Island that you might have heard about. It became the subject of a best-selling book and movie. Anybody here remember the Amityville Horror?
A few jaws dropped. Obviously, that had struck a familiar chord.
To this day, that remains one of the worst cases that we've ever been involved with, and certainly one of the most controversial, Ed said.
In the Amityville case in the mid-1970s, George and Catherine Lutz and their three children had been forced to flee from a house they had purchased 2 years earlier in the Long Island suburb of Amityville. They fled after having been victimized by what they said were supernatural forces. It turned out that a year before they bought the house, the eldest son of the previous owner had murdered the six sleeping members of his family. After investigation, the Warrens concluded that the house was haunted not by ghosts, but by inhuman spirits. But the Amityville case was only one of many highly publicized cases in which the Warrens had been involved. There was the case of the hauntings at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in 1972. The Warrens were called in to investigate a haunting at the home of the Academy's commanding general. And, of course, there was the highly publicized case of demonic possession in Brookfield, Connecticut, in 1979-80. In that case, a young man by the name of Arnie Johnson was charged with stabbing another young man, Alan Bono, to death. Johnson's defense? Not guilty by reason of demonic possession. Unfortunately for Johnson, the judge wouldn't allow the unusual defense, and he was found guilty of manslaughter. But the Warrens, who investigated the case, were convinced Johnson was possessed and had become possessed.
That was our most shocking case since the one in Amityville, Ed said.
The young man who had challenged Ed earlier seemed to be more accepting of what Ed was saying now that he'd heard of the many famous cases Ed had been called in to investigate. But when he snickered and leaned over, whispering something to the girl sitting next to him, Ed knew he hadn't yet convinced him completely.
Is something still bothering you? He asked.
The young man nodded.
Yeah, he said.
How come you publicize your cases so much? You seem like a couple of publicity hounds to me.
A big smile came over Ed's face. You can call us whatever you like, but the truth is that we positively want notoriety and exposure for our cases, he said. It is only through the exposure of these case histories that others who suffer the same diabolical fates can be enlightened about the existence of the preternatural world, and we expose cases only with the full consent of the people involved. There are literally hundreds of cases that we have kept from the public's eye because the people involved didn't want any publicity.
Ed explained that the publicity also spreads the word about the New England Society for Psychic Research, a Christian ministry he and Lorraine direct. The society is a metaphysical organization that bases its beliefs upon Christian doctrine and the teachings of Jesus Christ.
We've got dozens of volunteers who help us, Ed said. They receive no compensation. Their only reward is helping these victims of diabolical attacks.
Ed then turned on a tape recorder that sat on a table next to the lectern.
I think you might be interested in hearing this, he said, chuckling just a little.
On the tape, an elderly woman talked about a haunted house across the street from her. After a few minutes, Ed stopped the tape and warned the students to pay special attention.
The sounds you will hear in the background could not have been made by a human voice, he said.
He restarted the tape as the students strained to hear. In the background, a voice seemed to be laughing. But the voice sounded as if it were coming from the bottom of a well. And it was deep, guttural, and had a sinister tone. The disturbing laugh was repeated several times. Then the tape abruptly stopped.
If that isn't diabolical, I don't know what is, Ed said, turning off the machine.
As he headed toward the door, several of the students just stayed in their seats, stunned by what they had heard. Others charged after Ed and Lorraine to ask questions. Ed stood by the door, attempting to accommodate the students as much as he could, but Lorraine was tugging at his jacket.
Remember, we've got a message on the machine, and I have the feeling it may be an important one, she whispered into her husband's ear.
With her ESP abilities, proven in tests at UCLA, Lorraine was rarely wrong about a hunch or intuition.
Geez, I almost forgot, Ed replied.
Then he turned to the students surrounding them.
Sorry, kids, we've got to go, he said. We may have a new case.
They walked briskly into the house and headed directly to the telephone answering machine. Ed hit the play button and wandered over to the refrigerator to pour himself a glass of juice. An elderly voice played back on the little answering machine speaker.
Hello, this is Father Galen Beardsley in Warren, Massachusetts. A couple in my parish has been having trouble recently. Strange things have been happening to them. Terrible things. I fear their house may be possessed. I read about you in a book and thought you might be able to help. But hurry. The situation is deteriorating rapidly. Please call me as soon as possible. And God bless you.
Ed and Lorraine looked at each other.
Did you hear the way his voice was quivering? Lorraine said.
He's frightened, Ed said. We'd better call him right away. It was after 10, but the Warrens knew the priest would be anxiously awaiting their call.
Ed picked up the phone and dialed the number the priest had left on the tape. Father Beardsley was still in his office, sitting by the phone, paging through the demonologist. Nancy Theriault had called again since he had made his call to the Warrens. This time, she reported, Maurice was sitting in his easy chair, a faraway look in his eyes, reciting phrases in a language she didn't understand. At first, Father Beardsley suspected he was simply speaking French, his native tongue. But Nancy insisted it wasn't French. She had heard him speak French hundreds of times. This didn't sound anything like French. She said it sounded more like the language the priests used to use to say Mass, before everything had been changed by Vatican II.
Latin? Father Beardsley asked.
Yeah, Latin, Nancy said. I think he's speaking Latin. But he's never said a word in Latin in all the years I've known him. He was never an altar boy or nothing, and he's never gone to Mass all that much. How come all of a sudden he can speak Latin?
Father Beardsley was dumbfounded. I don't know, Mrs. Theriault, he said. I don't know. There are some things going on here that I can't explain. But I've called the people that can help, and I'm waiting to hear from them. He hung up the phone and opened his prayer book. He decided to say a few prayers, in the hope that it might hasten a return call from the Warrens. Father Beardsley had dozed off at his desk after about 5 minutes of prayer. It was late, and it had been a long day. When the phone rang about 10 minutes later, it almost knocked him off his chair. "Father Beardsley here," he answered. "Father, this is Ed Warren. Sorry I'm calling so late, but I just got finished teaching a class. You sounded anxious. How can I help?" The priest told Ed what had been going on with Maurice Theriault. He gave him a pretty good rundown on what he knew, trying hard to remember everything that Nancy had told him. He told Ed of Maurice's bleeding eyes, of his sudden ability to speak Latin, about how he was pushed down the church stairs by an invisible force. Father Beardsley may have forgotten some things, but he figured he had remembered enough to give Ed an idea of what was happening. "I fear their house may be haunted or possessed," the priest said. "But I'm no expert in the field. That's why I called you." Right away, from what Father Beardsley had recounted, Ed knew he'd have to go up to Warren and investigate. "Father, give me their number. I'll call them right away. I think Lorraine and I will have to drive up there tomorrow." After hanging up with the priest, Ed called the Theriaults and spoke to Nancy. She recounted some of the things that had been happening. Some of the incidents Ed had already heard from Father Beardsley. Some were new, such as the two Maurices, the car driving by itself, the messages scratched into Maurice's back. "I'd like to come up there tomorrow, if the weather's good," Ed said. "Is that okay with you?"
"Of course it's okay," Nancy replied. "I wish you could be here right now. I can't take much more."
"Don't you worry," Ed reassured her. "We'll do everything we can to help. And tonight, make sure to say your prayers." Nancy was so relieved. Now they were going to get some real help. When Ed hung up the phone, he turned on the television to get the weather forecast. It was February 17th, and there had been some talk about a snowstorm. Fortunately, the forecast was for clear skies until later in the week.
"Let's plan on getting up early," Lorraine said,
closing up the large road atlas she had been looking at.
"It's a pretty long drive, and I think we ought to get there with a few hours of daylight to spare."
"Sounds good," Ed said, heading off into the bedroom. Then a thought came to him. "Honey, what do you think about asking Karen Jaffe to come with us? She's been wanting to help us investigate a case, and it might be a good idea to have a police officer with us." Lorraine agreed right away.
"That's a great idea," she said. "I don't think she's working tomorrow. I'll give her a call." Karen Jaffe was a detective with a police department in Connecticut, about 45 minutes south of Monroe. In the course of her job, she had investigated many occult-type crimes and had developed an interest in the subject. She had even lectured on it to other police departments. Over the years, she had crossed paths with the Warrens several times, and they had come to be friends. When Lorraine called, Karen jumped at the invitation. And Lorraine was glad she had. Bringing a police officer along couldn't hurt, and the gun she carried would serve as a form of protection in case things got out of hand. Lorraine told Ed the good news that Karen had agreed to come with them. "I told her to be here by 10 o'clock, she said.
"That's good, because I don't want to leave much later than that," Ed replied.
As they got into bed, Ed reached over and picked up his well-worn Bible.
"I think I'll read a few passages before dozing off," he said to Lorraine.
"What do you make of this?" she asked.
"It sounds pretty frightening," he said. "I have a feeling we're going to have our work cut out for us."
Then he looked into Lorraine's worried eyes and grinned.
"Hey, who you gonna call?"
She laughed and felt better. Whenever Ed repeated that line from Ghostbusters, she always laughed. It helped to ease her anxiety. But she had a feeling there would be no joking when tomorrow rolled around. She said a prayer as her head hit the pillow. Ed and Lorraine were up bright and early the next morning. Lorraine prepared a hearty breakfast of bacon and eggs, and while they ate, they plotted their route to Warren on a road map. Monroe is in rural southeastern Connecticut, halfway between New Haven and the New York state line, about a two-hour drive from New York City. They'd head north on a couple of back roads until they could pick up I-84, the new interstate. Once on I-84, Ed figured they could make good time heading northeast toward Massachusetts. The I-84 would take them past Waterbury, Bristol, and also New Britain, the city where Maurice had lived years before. At Hartford, they'd take I-91 directly north toward Springfield, where they would catch the Massachusetts Turnpike east to the exit at Palmer. From there, it would be only a few minutes on two small roads, routes 32 and 67, until they got to Warren. The day was bitterly cold, but the skies were clear, so weather wouldn't be costing them time. In all, the ride would take a little more than 2 hours. They were so busy planning the trip and thinking about what they might have to confront that Lorraine almost forgot that it was February 18th, the anniversary of her father's death 17 years earlier. The realization called for a slight change in plans. "We'd better go to Mass," she told Ed. He agreed, and they hurried to get dressed and rush off to nearby St. Stephen's Church for the 8 a.m. service. At Mass, Lorraine prayed not only for the soul of her beloved father, but also for that of Maurice Theriault. She could feel that something terrible was going on in Warren, and that she and Ed were going to be in for a battle. Maybe the battle of their lives. After Mass was over, Ed and Lorraine headed back home to wait for Karen, and to pack up their beige Chevy Chevette with everything they would need to investigate the goings-on at Maurice Theriault's house. A bottle of holy water, a tape recorder, camera, a special crucifix that Ed took with him on all their cases, and relics of several saints, including Padre Pio, the venerated saint who was known for his stigmata, the near constant bleeding from his hands, feet, and left side, just like Christ on the cross. Padre Pio was also celebrated for innumerable miracles of healing. The relic had been given to the Warrens by officials of the church in Rome. Ed and Lorraine also made sure to wear medals of the Blessed Virgin around their necks. They never went on a case without them. Karen arrived shortly after 10. 38 years old, she looked trim and sturdy in her jeans and V-neck sweater. Her curly brown hair was pulled back in a ponytail. After a quick cup of coffee, they hit the road. On the way, they filled Karen in on as much as they knew about the case of Maurice Theriault. They had been driving about 2 hours and 15 minutes when they saw the sign on Route 67 that said, "Entering Warren." When they got to Brimfield Road, they began looking out for the farmhouse. Lorraine didn't need to check the number on the mailbox to know that they had arrived. As soon as they were within eyesight of the Theriault property, she pointed and said, "That's it. That's the house. I can feel it." Sure enough, it was. As they pulled into the driveway, the Warrens saw a modest farmhouse that was badly in need of repairs. It was perched on a knoll surrounded by several other buildings, including a makeshift greenhouse with plastic over it and a number of pieces of old farm equipment. The gravel driveway was the only evidence of any landscaping. The front yard was patrolled by a big German shepherd, surrounded by half a dozen kittens. As they got out of the car, Nancy Theriault opened the kitchen door, popped her head out, and said, "Welcome to our home. I'm glad you're here." She looked almost exactly as Lorraine had imagined her. She was wearing jeans and an untucked corduroy shirt. Her red-brown hair was curly, and she wore no makeup. She was a real country girl. And Lorraine could see that this country girl had been under incredible stress. Her darkened eyes and the lines on her forehead attested to that. "Come on in," Nancy said. "Maurice is at the table. I'm going to make some coffee." Inside, the room was heated by an old pot-bellied stove. Maurice sat at the table, staring into space. He wore coveralls and a corduroy shirt that looked a lot like the one Nancy was wearing. He had a pencil-thin mustache, and his brown hair was thinning a bit at the top. His leathery face evidenced a lifetime of hard work. But more than that, the aura Lorraine saw surrounding him was dark and muddy. Terrible. He's scary to look at, she thought. Ed sized Maurice up quickly, too, and saw that, despite his small size, he was a strong man. He had muscles on top of muscles. Ed glanced over at Karen Jaffe. He knew she had her gun in her purse, and he was glad of that. If Maurice was a nutcase, they might need it. And if he wasn't, well, they still might need it. They sat down around the table, sipped coffee, and talked for the next couple of hours. Nancy again did most of the talking, telling the Warrens of Maurice's lifetime of incredible incidents. She told the Warrens what she had once told Father Beardsley, that she thought Maurice or the house was somehow being haunted by the spirit of her mother. But right off the bat, Ed doubted that was the case. If the things Nancy was telling them were true, there was no way they could have been caused by a human spirit. What happened next only helped to confirm that feeling. As Nancy talked, Maurice mostly just sat there, nodding and staring blankly into space. But at one point, when Nancy spoke of Maurice's mother, Maurice put his hand to his brow and began to cry. Karen noticed it first, and when she did, she almost fell off her chair. Maurice was crying tears of blood. The veteran police detective had seen plenty of blood in her 13 years as a cop, but never anything like this. She nudged Lorraine to look. Simultaneously, Nancy and Ed had noticed the bleeding too. Nancy jumped up to get a box of tissues and handed one to Maurice, who dabbed at his eyes to soak up the blood. Once the bleeding had stopped, Ed began asking questions. "How often does this happen, Maurice?" he asked.
"It happens often enough," Nancy answered.
"Usually when he gets angry or upset." Ed mulled the possibilities over in his mind. Either Maurice had a rare medical problem, or the bleeding was a case of stigmata, the manifestation of the bleeding wounds of Christ. The bleeding stopped when Maurice stopped crying, but it would start up again several times before the day was over, whenever the discussion recreated some difficult and disturbing time in Maurice's troubled life. Ed had a sense that Maurice might have come under demonic possession, but that would have required an entry. Maybe there had been an incident that could have provided an entry point. By delving back into Maurice's past, Ed hit on a couple of matters that might explain what was happening. The first was the incident with Maurice and his father in the barn, back when Maurice was just a youngster. That unholy act, Ed figured, definitely could have opened a door for evil to enter. There was also the time when, as an overworked youngster in the fields, Maurice asked for the help of an invisible force, and seemed to get it. That could have provided another point of entry. And then there was the curse put on Maurice by old Hubert Emery. If the door was already open, that might have opened the door even wider, Ed thought. When they were through, Ed didn't say anything to Maurice or Nancy about what might have caused the unusual occurrences. Instead, he just told them that he would be in touch with Father Beardsley and would be sending some researchers up to the house at a later date to do some investigating. Ed, Lorraine, and Karen then drove off to the Salem Croft Inn in nearby West Brookfield to get some dinner and listen to the tapes of the conversation they had just concluded with Maurice and Nancy. Karen was shocked by several of the things she had heard, but she just couldn't get over Maurice's bleeding eyes.
"Do you think there's a medical explanation?" she asked.
Ed swallowed his last piece of apple pie, put down his fork, and leaned back in his chair.
"If only there were," he said.
"Then what do you think is going on?" Karen asked.
"I think something terrible is going on there,"
he said. I suspect Maurice is possessed. But we won't be able to say for sure until we conduct a full investigation. We've got to get a team in there right away. Back home again in Monroe the next day, Ed began calling some of his most trusted assistants, lining up a team that could assist in the investigation into the Maurice Theriault case. In addition to Karen, Ed would ask two college students, both named Chris, who often worked together on these cases, Chris McKenna and Chris Finberg. They were trusted assistants who never shied away from a frightening case. When Ed needed people to spend the night in a haunted house or with a person who was suspected of being possessed, the two Chrises were usually the first ones he would call. Kent Birch, a police detective with the Hartford, Connecticut Police Department, was another valuable assistant. Kent usually worked with his friend, Ryan Dufresne. Joey Taylor and Fred Salvio, two friends who worked in a nursing home in Bridgeport, not far from the Warrens' home in Monroe, also usually worked together. Joey would later become a subdeacon in Danbury. Rounding out the group would be Sonny Berryhill, a muscular weightlifter, Benjamin Massey, a student of the Warrens, and Jessica Spellman. Ed figured Sonny's strength might come in handy. But before Ed sent his troops up to observe, he decided he would need to return to Warren once more to talk with Father Beardsley. He and Lorraine decided to drive up on the weekend. They met with Father Beardsley in the rectory of St. Paul's Church at noon on Saturday. Ed and Lorraine had gotten a good feeling about him from their conversation on the phone that night, and their meeting in person only confirmed that feeling. The Warrens found the priest not only willing to work closely with them, but also willing to call on his friend and former classmate, the Most Reverend Timothy J. Harrington, a bishop, for help if necessary. That was good news as far as Ed and Lorraine were concerned. After talking at length with Father Beardsley, they had a feeling that the bishop might be needed, but for more than what the priest had anticipated. Father Beardsley had been out to bless the house, thinking it might be haunted or possessed. But Ed suspected something more hideous. Father, Ed said, I'm going to level with you. I think that Maurice has come under demonic possession. We haven't proven it, of course. We still have to do our investigation. But that's my suspicion. If it turns out to be the case, exorcism may be needed. And as you know, the only one who can authorize an exorcism is the bishop. We may need your help there. You've got it, Ed, the priest replied. If we need it, I'll call the bishop personally. But I hope to God we won't. Ed could see the apprehension in the priest's eyes. Frightened? He asked. Father Beardsley sat down at his desk, swung his chair around, and looked out the window to the street below. I still shudder when I think about the day the priest who preceded me here told me of his encounter with Satan, he said. He was pushed around for 6 hours. He was exhausted. He said he didn't ever want to do it again. He said he was in the same room with a demon. That priest died the next month at the age of 55. Does that answer your question? Ed realized he had asked a stupid question. Of course the priest was frightened. Who wouldn't be? I'm frightened too, Father, Ed replied. Why don't we go over to the church and pray? The priest said. The two men walked slowly out of the rectory and over to the church. As they walked together, they didn't say a word. The battle was about to begin. 10. Police Chief Jerry Siebert was still reeling from the events at the Theriault farmhouse 2 days before. He couldn't shake the image of Maurice, sitting there at the kitchen table, dazed and bleeding, out of his mind. He really preferred not to think about it, and usually he was good at shutting out the terrible things that happen to people, things that a cop sees in the normal line of duty. But this Theriault case was difficult to ignore. When Siebert had first become aware that there was something odd going on at the farmhouse on Brimfield Road, he simply figured he had an arsonist on his hands. But then that suspected arsonist, Frenchie Theriault, had come into the station and turned in his guns, making the incredible claim that he was possessed and was seeing a psychic. The normally unshakable ex-Marine could deal with that. Frenchy, he had concluded, was concocting a story to cover up having set his own place on fire to collect the insurance money. And he was probably paying a fortune teller to back up his story. As a 9-year veteran with an associate degree in criminal justice, Seabird knew that arson was the hardest crime to prove. But the 40-year-old cop also had confidence in himself and State Fire Marshal Dan Prescott. He figured that if they couldn't trip up this dim-witted farmer, they ought to turn in their badges. But then he and Trooper Kearns had been called to the farmhouse. Seabird didn't know what the heck had taken place, but he knew what he'd seen. He'd seen Frenchie covered with blood, and Nancy screaming hysterically. And then Father Beardsley had told him about the pair of demonologists that he'd called in. Psychics and demonologists. What next? Although Seabird had been brought up in the nearby village of Westbrookfield, he'd been around. During his 4-year stint in the Marines, Seabird had been stationed in Scotland and in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In addition to being widely traveled, he had studied for 2 years, pursuing an associate's degree in psychology. He could usually spot a con a mile away. And as much as he liked old Father Beardsley, he knew that the priest was getting old and wasn't as sharp as he'd once been. Seabird was determined to make sure that he and the town of Warren weren't going to be exploited, either by Frenchy or by these demonologists. Seabird decided he'd better take a drive up to the farmhouse to see what he could see. He parked his cruiser out on the road, out of sight, and scoped out the driveway to the Ferryall home. There he saw something that bothered him. There was a black Ford Elite parked in the driveway, a car he had never seen before at the Ferryall home. Moreover, he could tell from a distance that the car had out-of-state plates. The plate was blue, from Connecticut. He walked up the steep slope until he could make out the license plate. Seabird couldn't believe his eyes. The plate read, "Ghost." He didn't know whether to laugh or cry. But he knew what he would do as soon as he got back to the station. He'd run a check on that plate to see who he was dealing with. Seabird made it back to the station in record time. It didn't take long for the check to be completed. The car was registered to a Lorraine Warren of Monroe, Connecticut. The chief drove back out to Frenchie's the next day and confronted the farmer about the car with the ghost license plates. Maurice was just getting ready to leave for town and was surprised to see Seabird. The police chief approached Maurice without saying a word. Seabird, wearing mirrored aviation-style sunglasses that threw Maurice's image back toward him, folded his arms over his chest. "Frenchie, who's driving that black car with Connecticut plates?" he asked. "I saw it parked in front of your house the other day." The farmer glanced up and raised his eyebrows as if to ask, "What were you doing, spying on me?" But he decided against baiting the imposing officer. "Those are the psychics I told you about. The ones I'm seeing for my problem. The ones who told me to turn in my guns. They're helping me get rid of this thing that's haunting me." Seabird assumed a look of disbelief. "Psychics?" he said. "Yeah," Frenchie said. "Father Beardsley calls them demonologists." Seabird nodded. "Mind if I come by and meet them sometime?" he asked. "Suit yourself," Frenchie replied. "I don't care. They'll be back up on Saturday." Maurice wasn't crazy about having Seabird poking about, but maybe it would be good if he understood, he thought. When Saturday rolled around, Seabird decided to go and meet these so-called demonologists. Ed Warren was walking down the path leading from the Ferryall's side door when Seabird pulled up in his cruiser. As soon as he saw the police car, Ed turned around and began heading back to the door, pretending not to have noticed. "Hold it a second, pal," the chief barked from his open window. He turned off the engine. "This guy is starting to irritate me already," he thought. Ed didn't turn around, but kept on walking. Now Seabird was getting irritated. This guy's not going to make it easy for me, he thought.
Excuse me, fella, the police chief said, getting out of the cruiser. But I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Ed stopped and turned to face the cop. The usually easygoing demonologist didn't like what he saw.
Look at this guy, Ed thought. He thinks he's General Patton.
That uniform, those boots, that shining brass, that condescending attitude, that stiff, macho body language. However, he said,
Hello, officer. My name is Ed Warren. Is there something I can do for you?
Ed, figuring he had better show some respect, added,
Why don't we go in and have a cup of coffee?
I just want to know what you folks are doing here, Siebert said.
I like to know what's going on in my town.
Ed Warren had faced police officers before. They never seemed to believe. He wasn't going to let General Patton interfere with his efforts to rid Maurice of the demon that was making his life insufferable.
I said I just want to know who you folks are and what you're doing here, Siebert said. Just a matter of routine.
Maybe, Ed thought. Maybe not. He decided to take the initiative.
Hey, Chief, Ed said, touching his arm lightly. I can tell by your attitude that you are a non-believer.
Siebert didn't flinch, and Ed continued. But you are involved in something here that you don't understand, and that you are not willing to accept. And that's because you don't want to accept it. But to truly comprehend what's happening to Maurice Theriault, you'll need some understanding of what this is all about.
Ed wondered if this was registering at all.
Siebert shrugged. Actually, Ed was getting through, but Siebert simply hated thinking about stuff like this. The whole subject frustrated him.
Now come on, Chief, Ed said. Let me explain everything that's happened here.
With that, Siebert relaxed a little. They walked together into the farmhouse. Nancy was half expecting Chief Siebert to show up, because of his little interrogation of Maurice the day before. She quickly poured two cups of coffee, and then went into the bedroom to tidy up. The chief listened to Ed for 10 minutes. Although impressed with Ed's professionalism, he knew that he and this demonologist were there for different reasons. Siebert knew that he was there for a criminal investigation. This psychic investigator was there for something else, the chief thought. Maybe money. Maybe sensationalism. Maybe religion. Whatever, their interests weren't the same. Siebert knew he wasn't going to get any help from the Warrens. That was obvious. He just hoped he wasn't going to be hindered too much in his investigation.
Well, I'd appreciate it if you'd keep me informed, Siebert said, on the way back to the cruiser.
Sure thing, Chief, Ed replied. Just as much as you need to be, he thought. Siebert knew that he was being shut out. He walked back to his cruiser and drove off, still trying to put his finger on just what was going on. He promised himself he would continue to investigate until he was satisfied that Frenchie Theriault was, or wasn't, an arsonist. One might think that the church would be eager to perform exorcisms. After all, what could be greater proof of the power and efficacy of the Roman religion than the ability to cure what can't be otherwise cured or understood? Aside from miracles, what greater example of the ultimate power for good? But as is the case with miracles, the church, afraid of the sensationalism and exploitation which inevitably accompanies such cases, is often reluctant to step in. One of its requirements, in the case of exorcism, is that the person believed to be possessed undergo a psychiatric evaluation. During the ordeal of Maurice Theriault, the Reverend Walter Harris, a spokesman for the Boston Archdiocese, expressed that reluctance in an interview printed in a Boston newspaper on the subject of demonic possession. In my 21 years in the priesthood, I've never heard of a genuine case of possession, he said. The advance of psychology puts a whole different perspective on these cases. So there was much rejoicing in the Theriault house when the diocese agreed to furnish a Catholic psychiatrist to evaluate Maurice.
This could be the first step toward freeing Maurice of the demons that were making his life a living hell, they thought. Ed, Lorraine, Nancy, and Maurice were sitting together at the kitchen table on a sunny Monday morning, discussing the news the Warrens had brought.
"Now they'll see that it's not his imagination or some trick he's playing," said Nancy.
Ed Warren, who had seen hundreds of cases of demonic possession, was less sure. He knew that if the church is reluctant to acknowledge cases of possession, then the psychiatric profession is 100 times more reluctant. He was trying to appear confident for the Theriall's sake, but his concern was mirrored in his body language. He sat stiffly, chin in hand, looking out the window. He mulled the situation over in his mind. The problem, from a doctor's point of view, is that many of the symptoms attributed by the superstitious to demonic forces can often be equally well assigned to chemical and psychological disorders. A doctor is aware that people who suffer from what is now known to be epilepsy, for example, were once thought to have been possessed. "Let's hope we get one who has an open mind, and who can admit that there are things he doesn't understand," said Ed, as Lorraine nodded agreement. Maurice stared at the crumpled napkin in front of him, saying nothing. For him, this meeting might be the beginning of a cure, an end to the bizarre occurrences that had haunted his life since childhood, and that were now tearing it apart. He wondered if he would ever feel normal. Not that he knew what that was, exactly. The group sat in silence at the kitchen table, each person speculating about the upcoming meeting with the psychiatrist. The ring of the telephone shattered the quiet. Nancy jumped, then quickly moved in the direction of the phone.
"Hello?"
she said, her voice showing a mixture of anticipation and trepidation.
"Yes, Father. He's here. Just a second."
She turned to the table and looked at Ed.
"It's for you," she said. "It's Father Beardsley."
Ed got up and took the call. After speaking quietly for a minute or two, Ed hung up and turned back to the table. "He wants us to come up to the rectory," he announced. "That's where the doctor will meet Maurice." In the car on the way over, the silence persisted. Even talkative Nancy was deep in thought. Maurice stared out the window, expressionless. He had a suspicion of psychiatrists. Headcrackers, he called them. What if he was crazy, and they locked him up, but he was still possessed and didn't have Nancy there with him? The usual sensations of helplessness and trepidation were becoming magnified under all the official scrutiny. He prayed silently to the Virgin Mary. Maurice had a childlike belief that Father Beardsley, having a special connection to God, could somehow interpret his good side and convey it upward. So he wore a large smile when he saw the priest sitting behind his desk at the rectory of St. Paul's. He trusted the old country priest. Father Beardsley